This is the Celia podcast series. Celia is a funded project which explores intersectional life course inequalities amongst LGBTQI plus citizens in four European countries. It's comparative in nature, and that includes in terms of the countries involved, Scotland, England, Germany and Portugal, and the range of theories, methods and voices it aims to include. I'm Yvette Taylor and I'm the Principal Investigator for the Scotland team, and I've been working with Dr. Maya Andreessen and Dr. Mattson Lawrence as the named researchers to conduct policy analysis of the Scottish and broader UK context. I've been doing fieldwork in Scotland on a series of dissemination events. Research plans on dissemination have been affected by the global pandemic, but I'm committed to telling the story of what we found. Finding out things always, of course, happens in particular circumstances, and we're keen to probe at who came forward to talk to us and what we've missed out as researchers. Finding out happens with particular skills and tools, and I'm concerned to relate this search to continued feminist questions around, say, researchers' positionality, and to continued questions of intersectionality. In total, we conducted interviews with 45 LGBTQI plus interviewees across Scotland and across their age range, which in itself is quite unusual. Typically, studies and policies on queer lives focus on younger groups and often positions them as at risk. For example, at risk of bullying or more susceptible to mental health issues. This research asks, what are the generational changes to queer life course? Are things getting better or worse? What's held in common across time and place, where Scotland has recently made much of its commitment to LGBTQI plus inclusion, and is different to the rest of the UK, or specifically is different to England? In this first podcast, I talked to Dr. Charanjit Mann, reader at the University of Strathclyde, and Celia user group member. Our user group helps us to keep informed with and accountable to a range of policymakers and practitioners. And here I talk to Charanjit about questions of Scottishness in the context of queer intersectional lives. How might discourse needs on Scottish civic nationalism gloss over enduring inequalities, including within LGBTQI plus groups? How might ideas of nationalism be related and revived by ideas of things getting better for some groups? How can researchers address questions of privilege, including whiteness, in research on queer communities? Celia is beginning to publish on these themes, drawn on the empirical data and in conversation with our user group. Here is the podcast conversation between myself and Dr. Charanjit Mann. What is Celia about? Well, Celia stands for Comparing Intersectional Life Course Inequalities Amongst LGBTQI plus Citizens in Four European Countries. And it has multiple audiences. So academics across disciplines, I think, should be interested in Celia. There's policy audiences at a moment where we're experiencing a lot of contention, a lot of policy making around LGBTQI subjects. And I think it's got a broader public interest in terms of the representations of LGBTQ plus lives, the mainstreaming of those representations and depictions. So I think we have multiple audiences and multiple disciplines. We are an interdisciplinary, international team. And we are right in a moment of huge change. We have seen the equalities legislation of 2010. So this represents a good time to assess those changes and the progress, if anything, that has been made. But it also represents a juncture where we're seeing a departure from, an arguable departure from European policy making, with the UK now thinking about what Brexit means, and particularly what Brexit means for LGBTQI plus citizens. So I think the discipline, or the sub-discipline of sexuality, has had a problem in applying an intersectional analysis or intersectional thinking when sexuality tends to be the main focus of concern. So what that has meant for younger people is that their lives are all often
framed through ideas of risk and harm, that these are subjects that fall out of education or fail in education. And I think if we look at the other end of the life course, we think of older LGBTQI plus subjects as maybe sad and lonely and lacking care. So the idea for the project was to think more intersectionally across the life course and look at these normative points. So, for example, what happens in school, what happens in the workplace, and what happens post working lives and into retirement, but also what might happen if we rethink these pivotal points. Are these really the points that matter in queer lives, or should we be queering these normative points too? So I think there's lots to care and connect. I think lots of sexualities and queer research has been framed by questions of care. And of course, we're writing in a particular time as well, when questions of care and what that means for LGBTQI communities are again heightened.
That's interesting, like, because there's been such a glut of research in LGBTQ issues. So it sounds like part of the originality of your project is framed in its methods and approaches. But I also saw that it has a really particular 3-year period, 2018 to 2021. And you touched on a few of the issues like Brexit that frame this moment in this period. What do you think were or are the particular issues that came up in research and writing in this period?
Yeah, of course, you're always kind of writing into the future. When you imagine a research project, you don't necessarily know the challenges and the changes that are going to happen during that research project, and Brexit being one of those challenges. So I think for the Scottish team in particular, that has posed a new question of how different or similar to England in particular, or our European partners, will policymaking be as Scotland negotiates Brexit. So I think right now there's a huge amount of claims making around what LGBTQI plus lives in Scotland might look like and how it might continue to use a more European legislation and hang on to that as being similar to its EU partners. But I think drawing on the qualitative interview data with our 45 participants, many of them did talk about how this represented a moment of heightened insecurity, a question of what will happen now to long fought for and supposedly won rights, the direction and lead that the European Union has taken on providing those rights. So many of them were very uncertain in the current climate. Although we're heartened by Scottish policy making, we're also a bit sceptical around some of the claims making that Scotland was and is making around being world leading, say, in terms of LGBTQI rights. Some of that positioning seems to be as distinct against English policy making, but at the same time we are experiencing similarities there to our English counterparts and our European counterparts in terms of, say, the increase in hate crime, the increase in right-wing activism. So I think these are enduring questions about how that will be played out in the future. So capturing that has been somewhat of a challenge as people themselves are trying to work out what that means for their communities. But another challenge for the project, and particularly for the fieldwork, has been coronavirus. And certainly there's been emerging thoughts on how this might definitely impact LGBTQI communities. It has interrupted the fieldwork. And again, in a Scottish context, that has meant me thinking about questions of digital divides, particularly for more rural communities, particularly in terms of a life course approach and how thinking how maybe older LGBTQI plus people may not be experiencing the same levels of inclusion in new platforms. And again, another policy process that Celia had to negotiate was the GRA, the Gender Recognition Consultation in Scotland, and the fracturing, I suppose, that you've seen around LGBTQI plus alliances and a real increase in transphobia. So positioning our project in those different policy and public moments has been somewhat of a test. You never step out of those lenses. I think that is something that projects should be engaging with. And I think another thing to say there would probably be about the repetitions across time, rather than these kind of queer milestones where you get the legislation or you get the community group and then you somehow get equality. But it's always something to be fought for. And again, in the Life Course project, we see generational repetitions of uncertainties around policy making, whether equality is achievable. And one of the things that occurs to me as an example there is around Section 20A or Section 2A, as it was known in Scotland. During the course of the project, I attended a 20th anniversary event at the Scottish Parliament. And even young people who hadn't directly experienced Section 20A, so younger than myself, still had a community memory of the significance of Section 28. So I think that shows the ways that inequalities do travel and do have a legacy beyond our own lives.
What do you think the particular challenges are with working on the Cilia project?
Particular challenges, I suppose some of these would be framed as opportunities as well, of course, but I think working on a comparative international project with four partners working in different national contexts does mean that we have to reconcile what our national policy bodies, organisations, community groups might want, need and hope for the project, and how we can usefully compare national data sets so that it truly is an international data set. And some of that is just practical too. How do you collaborate when you're all in four different countries? And again, with the global pandemic, we're all working online, and so we're having to cross time zones and so forth. It is manageable, but it is a challenge. And I think the direction of funding and sexualities and gender research arguably only gets a little part of that funding, but the direction of funding tends to be to consolidate and to work with more and more partners. And I think there are questions there about differences and how to operationalise and best work that capacity when it is spread across time and places. I think something that all funders now are and should be concerned with is career development for PIs, for co-Is, and for any research associates. And I think for me, there's also a question there at a time where higher education faces many questions about the sector, when sub-discipline research is fairly marginalised, sexuality and gender research arguably more so. What kind of capacity can PIs build up beyond the course of, a 3-year funded project, and how can that best capacitate everyone in a project team, or is that an impossibility? So I really don't have many answers to that. Cilia has been good in terms of strategic opportunities for some of the early career researchers. So Dr. Matthew Morans took advantage of a BSA, British Sociological Bursary, and was able to attend the BSA for free, which was great as a conference place. And Maya Andreessen, the other researcher on the Scottish team, will take part in a DIAL summer school. So there are moments, and we are all building on learning from our different interdisciplinary research skills and experiences. I've also worked with an editor and a designer in the course of the project. And what we have to do as researchers is to ensure that we do have a broad audience and that we make an impact in the world. But that impact likely will suppress the life of the project. So it's a question about balance as well. I think that's, realistically, I would say that is one of the challenges of the projects, where we do have to publish, we do have to find the findings, but we also have to work with different users and audiences. So the project does have a user group, which has been really fantastic. And it's composed of academics, policymakers, volunteer organisations, their sector organisations. But again, the questions that they might ask and the hopes and expectations that they might have of us do tend to vary. So always a balancing act, always worthwhile.
There's an interesting question about findings. So what are your findings so far, and who do you think would be interested in them and why?
Yeah, so we have interviewed 45 people across Scotland, and we have already published from a paper from the policy analysis, which was looking at the UK government's LGBT action plan and critically examined the government's claims around LGBT lives getting better. And within that, there was an apology for Section 28 in a sense that LGBT lives were getting better and progress could be made in terms of resource and areas of concern, so around education and the workplace, workplace discrimination and so on. And many of those action points resonated with the empirical data, so people's real experiences of feeling excluded at school and how that might translate into the labour market. I think Celia has found important generational differences and similarities in our sample. So, for example, educational experiences of exclusion or digital participation. I think there are resonances with literature that already exists in terms of seeing that there's certain risks on failures, educational failures in LGBT lives. But the Scottish data amends some of those messages, I think, and updates some of that data. And that our sample does speak to the ways that LGBT groups can also be resistant and resilient. It's a word that sometimes has a negative connotations because it overlooks some structural inequalities often and anticipates the individual to solve or be able to deal with the blows. But I think in terms of the sample, we have a very educated sample, which means that despite the difficulties, for our sample, LGBT plus people are achieving in skills and often going on to postgraduate degrees. So that made me think of the educational context and policymaking around schools and universities right now, where again, and to a certain extent this is right, that it focuses on negative experiences, but how can we think beyond those negative experiences too, and what might be the positive stories to tell around that and to tell around educational achievements? How might we think, for example, of students and pupils also offering peer support rather than just thinking about the teacher who fails LGBT inclusion in the classroom? Are there examples of workplaces really exceeding diversity as a tick box and really being quite innovative and creative in fulfilling their equalities obligations? Or is diversity still just seen as a tick box exercise? In terms of, say, matters of life and death, I think there are our interviews did report feeling inequalities around reproductive health, for example, and a lack of, say, care plan or recognition that could be an issue for older LGBT plus people who are navigating end of life, say. And there has been a huge literature around families of choice. We know that, say, LGBT people might be estranged from their family and might be reliant upon a more diverse sense of family, including friends as family. And I think we have to incorporate more of those understandings of care as we're imagining these life courses. So I think the main take-home message from the findings would be around the continued existence of differences and inequalities within LGBTQI populations. Now, that might not be such a revelation if we think about it, but there are still typical stories that do get told around LGBT lives and stories that get missed out and are rather absent. So in focusing on an intersectional approach, we can continue to ask the questions and provide some of the answers around the ways that LGBT lives intersect with questions around class, questions around race, questions around disability. I am confident that Celia can answer some of those questions.
Why is the concept of life course so important for your study of LGBTQI plus lives? And further from that, what do you think the key transition points are in queer lives? And further to that, like, have they changed over time? Are those transition points different now than they were 10 or 20 years ago?
Yeah, I think how we might imagine a normative life course in terms of progression, in terms of stages, so from school to work, through work achievements, through to post-work and retirement and end of life, I think it is imagined as stages, and I think there's been a lot of writing around that. But and these are certainly real building blocks, if you like, and real material moments where things can go right or things can go wrong. So what does it mean to achieve in school, and how might that feed into future work opportunities and plans for pensions and so on? But I think LGBTQI people in our interviews question some of those neat conceptualizations of those stages, or an easy flow through from school to work, from school to university, and show how at multiple points these can be interrupted. Now, that interruption might not be a failure. It might not represent a risk that you don't recover from. So I do want to get away from this idea of LGBTQI plus subjects being risky or failing or not achieving, but there's these interruptions, and I think we can look at these interruptions positively in terms of thinking, is this a queer moment whereby LGBTQI plus people are able to do something differently to their heterosexual peers, and that difference becomes productive? Does it involve questioning social norms across relationships, across the kind of communities we might want, hope and expect, and the kind of politics we might imagine as possible? Is that productive? Or in some ways, can it be quite destructive? So if you're constantly receiving workplace discrimination, even if that's on a low level, does that then shape and affect your friendship groups and your social networks and your sense of community and social value? So I don't want to... I'm not inevitably tied to this idea of life course. I think it is something we have to query as well. I don't think that there is a right time to come out, for example. And certainly we are seeing lots of examples of people not coming out in school, where some of the literature suggests this is really a key moment, and what are we going to do about LGBT plus subjects at school? Well, maybe not all of our interviews came out at school, and maybe had longer journeys and tell their stories of coming out very differently. So what does it mean to come out later in life, and how does that transform ideas of the life course if you've known yourself as previously heterosexual, so living a heterosexual life? So I think while these categories are material and useful for conceptualising key points, it's important that we kind of stretch our imagination so that we're not just following a linear, fixed life course, but also asking questions around what resources do we have to imagine that stretch for ourselves and for others.
Considering this is a project which focuses on LGBTQI lives, why is feminist theory and methodology so important?
Feminist theory and methods is really important for Cilia research, and it's quite frustrating, again, in the current policy climate and public climate that I'm working in, that sometimes, often, the value of feminism, a feminist politics, a feminist positioning in academia and research has to be repeated again and again. And I think some of that frustration is productive, and that these debates and issues are never solved, so have to be revisited again. One example of that would be the acronym itself, LGBTQI+. And the acronym is always disputed and always incomplete. But as I've mentioned earlier, there is real disputes around who is included in that, who's included in that right now. And this is not a new contention for feminist politics, feminist theorization, feminist activism. I think for me, feminism has always attended to questions of positionality, and that includes an attentiveness to how we're positioned in our research questions, our research actions, and a care for reflexivity in practice. So what that means is it's not just enough for me to state my identity as a queer researcher or as somebody, you know, stretching across LGBTQI+ as an acronym, but how that's put in practice So how do my connections with queer community matter in the research project? That's about having a user group. It's also about writing across different mediums. So the project has a newsletter that reaches out to different communities and tries to convey the research differently. So I think it's about doing feminism in practice. For me, one of the key conceptual tools and vocabularies that feminism has given me, and I've mentioned reflexivity, but it's this idea of intersectionality. And for me, that's always a question, again, of practice and how questions of inclusion and exclusion are dealt with on a research project. So it's always an effort, and it will always fail because you have to practice, you have to put that into practice again. So for me, it's about the potential of intersectionality and attending to different inequalities and being attentive when you have missed out certain groups, certain categories, and certain categories that matter across, particularly across gender, class, and race, for example. So for me, it's really important to hold on to this project as a feminist project and incorporate long-standing feminist ideas around gender inequality, for example. And one of the projects that I've been working on whilst completing Cilia, and I've been working on that with Dr. Maddie Bees at Strathclyde University, is a project called Feminist Repetitions in Higher Education, Interrupting Career Categories, where we look at long-standing feminist concerns and how these have to be reanimated. And almost a reminder of these are not new debates, that they're rather repeated concerns.
You've described how Cilia deals with intersectionality and works across the generations to understand the different types of inequalities that queer people face. But could you say a bit more about what the next chapter would be for Cilia in trying to understand the multiple vectors of inequality that queer people face?
Yeah. So the next challenges for Cilia are around, I think, questions of privilege as well as precarity. So in Cilia, there are many reported experiences of inequalities and hardships, but I think it's also important to think about the ways that people find ways out of hardship and precarity. What does work? How might we think about LGBTQI plus community as also occupying places of privilege in terms of class and race particularly? So for example, to connect these questions around my previous work around working class lesbian life and other projects such as Lesbian and Gay Parents, which happened in a moment before we had same-sex marriage, happened in the context of a global recession. We're now possibly already in another recession. These questions of class inequality don't disappear, they reappear, and I think you can already chart differences. And this is something I've seen in previous research project, differences between amongst LGBTQI plus community. So for example, in the Lesbian and Gay Parenting Project, one of the awkward questions that I faced was around what privileges then do middle-class parents have in the context of social disadvantage, where middle-class parents might be doing all that they can to buffer against disadvantage and inequality and equip their kids as well as they can in terms of school success. How do we query those narratives of progress, and how might progression for some mean a lack of progress for others? So I want to continue to tease out those differences and attend to intersectional life course inequalities. And sometimes that means surpassing the usual story and surpassing the usual research subjects and being attentive to when we miss groups out. I think, although I've done a lot of work in class, particularly, like gender and like sexuality, it's never static. It's always responsive. There's always new and old divides re-emerging. And I think it's interesting to consider in this moment of potentially global recession, and I'm not sure we're in a post-COVID situation, but in a post-COVID moment, what will the effect be on LGBTQI lives across the life course? I don't think we know enough about how that has disrupted, say, inclusion policies in education, how advancements might be retracted if they're reliant on resources. We do know that there's been a lot of positive policy making around LGBTQI plus lives, but some of that is reliant on voluntary services organisations or third sector underfunded groups. So if the resources are retracted, where does that work go? And can we then think about, to go back to the LGBT action plan, can we think about LGBT lives getting on and getting ahead, or are we still stuck in the same moment of inequalities? What might researchers do about that? So I think it is a question that I will continue to revisit, as I point out also the privileges, opportunities, moments of resistance and different activisms, including intergenerational activisms and conversations across the life course.